The Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show with your host, Andrew Carrington Hitchcock.
Hello, everybody. And joining me today, returning guest, I know he's very popular with the audience, is Ray West of the UK. BigLies.org is his website. I'm going to bring him up right now. Ray, are you with me?
Yep, I'm here, alive and kicking.
Excellent. Well, great.
Great to have you on board.
So you talk us through, give the audience the background to what you want to talk about today.
Okay, the title I chose was Hitler an Agent, which of course is quite a controversial topic. And the subtitle is How the Master Race Won the Second World War. It's an ironical comment on Jews. Now, let me go straight into it here. I don't really like teaser titles, so I'll go straight to the main point here. I think the point of the Second World War was to destroy whites, as many as possible, partly in Russian territories, because, of course, there are millions of non-Jews in Russia, and in Germany, because they were, or tried to be, Jew-aware. They were pretty unique in that. And the whole thing, the whole of the Second World War, was provoked by Jews working internationally in close networking with each other. And my view I've come to now is that Hitler was an agent, along with many of the top NSDAP officials, you know, of that party, of the so-called Workers' Party in Germany. It's a huge issue, huge event. Obviously, I can't cover everything. I'll try and sketch out bits of evidence. And we'll start here with propaganda and the way Jews start wars, because of their secrecy and behind-the-scenes issues, and also things like bribery and corruption of the police and so on, and violence and media control. The idea is basically easy enough. You provoke violence with false flags and so on. For example, the First World War was begun by assassinations and crimes Europe-wide, including rather odd groups like people who mimicked suffragettes and people in Ireland posing as religious groups. And of course, in Russia, there was Jewish violence, including assassinations. And there were others. There were anarchists, so-called, in Japan, and so-called Christians in Korea, throwing bombs, that kind of thing. And of course, it was backed by the media then, which was it was prepared over many, many years by Reuters, for example. Britain might just as well have been neutral, but Britain was coerced. The ruling cliques in Britain, which of course you have to distinguish from the British, the Jewish and Jew-related ruling cliques. The question of how much they're related is a difficult one, but as a first approximation, we may as well regard it as being Jewish. There were things like the sinking of the Lusitania. Anyway, that's how wars are started, typically. It's a long process, but I mean, the steps are simple enough, really, and most people are very liable to this kind of problem. And the important thing to note here is that the Jews are not included in the wars. It has to be other people. And I mean, for example, quite an interesting example here is Jan Lamprecht of History Reviewed, who, after many years of thought, discovered the importance of Jews in South Africa in ruining the whites there. But he's still thinking in terms of white versus black wars and not wars against Jews.
I'll just jump in there. I've had Jan on a few times, and he's certainly awake to the Jewish issue now.
He certainly is, yeah.
The other thing I'll just jump in with quickly, obviously what you're saying today is going to be controversial to a lot of people, certainly on the alt-right side, who laud and magnify Hitler as the figurehead. And, you know, from my point of view, I see where you're coming from, but when I look at things like Mein Kampf, and I can't read it all out because it's from the section, part 12, sorry, let me just, I've got it here. No, section 11, People and Race. And he goes through in letters, letter A to letter K. Yeah, yeah. You know what I'm talking about. And at the start, he said, in order to know the Jew properly, it is best to study the road he has taken through other nations during recent centuries. It will be enough to follow through one example in order to fully understand. Since his career has always been the same, just as the peoples he devours have remained the same, in the interests of simplicity, we will break up his development into definite steps, which I will indicate by letters of the alphabet. And, of course, this goes on for a few pages, so it's too long to read. But my point being, of course, there he comes right out and says that the enemy is primarily the Jews. So I imagine some of the audience will be saying, well, how can Hitler be a British agent when he wrote things like that? So can you focus on that as well, please, Ray?
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah, he's not I wouldn't say he's a British agent. He was a Jewish agent.
Oh, okay.
Jews basically ran the. By that stage, they ran the Soviet Union, they ran the USA, and they ran Britain and France, for that matter. In considerable detail, mostly hidden, mostly financial. The thing with Hitler is that he was, he was a kind of messianic figure, and you have to. One of the things about messiahs is that they favour a new start, a sort of rebirth, and that means they don't look too much at the past history. I mean, for example, Germany had wars. For example, there was war with Sweden. There was a 30 years war. There were lots of wars in Germany, but he didn't refer to those at all. He didn't discuss whether those were caused by Jews. So his mention to he had to mention Jews, and there's a case that, well, it was actually mentioned in the New York Times in, I think it was 1920, that shrewd observers maintain that Hitler was pretended to be anti-Semitic, but he wasn't really. There were plenty of people in Germany who were Jew aware who were very anti-Semitic, but they very anti-Jewish. But the history, so to speak, focused on Hitler. Hitler was given the publicity. So I wouldn't take that too seriously. You can't, when you're dealing with propaganda, you have to assume that there's a possibility of people lying. You know. So I'll get back to that in passing, probably. But as I was saying, Jan Lamprecht talks about whites versus black wars, but not wars against Jews. And of course, it's important from the Jewish point of view of the Second World War that it was posited as a war between Germany and Russia. This was a Russo-German thing. They had to concentrate on that because their own part was to be kept in the background. Anyway, let me come to my experience with propaganda generally. And again, it's fairly simple stuff here, really. Going back to Thucydides, there's a tradition of battles being described in a rather childish way, you know, a kind of James Bondy thing, a bit like Jane Austen is for women, you know. Incidentally, there's an alternative view of Jane Austen. I've put that on my website recently. But anyway, you have this childish thing with, you know, explosions going on and all the stuff. But the background detail of wars is usually secret, and it's usually kept so in case the losers get upset. And if you remember, for example, Judge Gray praised David Irving for his descriptions of battle. It's the same kind of thing. If you describe them properly, you've got all the manufacturing, all the transport, all the costs, and all the rest of it to do it properly. But most people are not interested in the serious history about war. And let me make another point to you, which is that some wars are essentially fake. There's quite an interesting example in Miles Mathis about saying that the Wars of the Roses were decided in advance. And there were just a few skirmishes as a kind of pretext. So that was hardly counts as a war at all, despite the name. But of course, on the other hand, you get wars which are very long and vicious. And usually, of course, there's some background reason, such as profits from arms or control over the entire future of a territory. So you've got Jews have their own particular reasons and methods for starting wars, and also their own particular ways of going about getting them going. Now, I want to go here into other details about, for example, about intelligence is the other thing. Intelligence in the sense of nothing intellectual, just having information. And I mean, for example, there was a German journalist, Sorge, who was supposed to have, I believe with evidence, to have actually informed Stalin about German troop movements. Money, of course, would be run by Jews from probably mostly from New York. So the information about materiel and money would be known to Jews. So would intelligence. I'll go on to that again in the future, but Bletchley Park is the most notorious thing in Britain, and it's not generally known. It wasn't to me until a few days ago that, of course, Bletchley Park was full of Jews, had a large number of Jews in it, and of course they would presumably communicate in their own way. I'm sure they must have, for example, had systems of communicating maybe in Yiddish or Hebrew or something. in particular with Stalin, but also probably with Germany. Anyway, I think it's fair to say that the 1913, the Federal Reserve, was possibly the most important part of the 20th century. I'll call it the Jewish century, for want of a better title. Anyway, we now know there was obviously after the First World War ended, there were still some puzzles left over. The Great War, so-called, came to an unexpected end. The Germans just kind of stopped, as it were, and then it was the Germans were beaten down with the Treaty of Versailles. And of course, everybody knows that Balfour's offer with Israel was no doubt significant in the First World War, including, of course, the U.S. entry, after Wilson had promised, in quotes, that would never happen. And there's another possibility, which various people have pointed out, is that Russia was actually offered up secretly to Jews in combination with European and American industrial companies. It's important to realize that. The extent to which Jews were influential in Russia itself, the Russian Empire itself, Russia was a sort of territory, but there's a big land empire, not dissimilar to the British Empire, except it was on land. Let me just mention some Miles Mathers stuff now. Some people don't like him. I've never seen any serious attempts to debunk him. All this stuff made is typical kind of lightweight, the stuff that Jews do, lightweight lies and concentration on little details, that kind of stuff. So anyway, he's made some serious attempts to move log jams, and where most people don't even know there are logs there. And let me just recommend Lenin.pdf, which looks at genealogies and concludes that Tsar Nicholas II and Lenin too were both Jews, or, you know, near enough Jews. And Lenin actually had aristocratic qualifications in Russia. He wasn't at all a serf or a peasant or anything. And I think at the same time, when Cromwell was taking over Britain on behalf of Jews, there was something similar in Russia, although I don't know the details of it. And anyway, so don't assume that Russia is Russian. There's just as a lot of these other places, there's a Jewish layer on top of it. And there's another, now for the point of view of this talk here, there's another file by Mathis called Hiller.pdf. It's Hiller, not Hitler. 45 pages, in which he sets out to show that all the other big names, as well as Hitler, were Jewish, including Goebbels, Himmler, Hess, and Eichmann. He makes a good case. It's mostly based on looking at genealogies, because, of course, most people are quite concerned. The genealogies tend to be accurate. You've got quite a few people involved in them. And the Weimar Republic was... He's got a quite good analysis of that as well. In a lot of these cases, there are historical events which are kind of brushed over, and in a very evasive way. For example, the criminals of November 1918, and the Mathis analysis, which seems to be correct, is that these people were set up, these Jews typically, like Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, you know, a Jew from Poland, were instructed to pretend to be left or centre or whatever it was. But at the same time, there were workers' councils being set up, and he mentions two leaders here, Richard Müller and Emil Barth, or Barth. And the workers' councils were the real dangers. The workers thought it was a real revolution, and so they stepped in. Now, and that wasn't allowed. Now, there's other evidence here. The 140 top Nazi officers were Jewish, including two field marshals, 15 generals, and 23 colonels. And there's evidence like this. Of course, it's difficult to get hold of, but I'm happy that there's some truth in all that. Now, let's look at Britain here. Now, in the late 19th century and throughout the 20th century, you know, the master race, quotes, Jews, were all immigrating to Britain, usually secretly, and getting themselves registered as English, Welsh, or Scottish. They tended to like Welsh and Scottish because they sounded alien to start with. There's the book by A.H. Lane, which I put on my website, called The Alien Menace. Gives a lot of details, and they inserted themselves into things like music halls and film news and stuff, and also in things like physics, history, psychoanalysis, of course, would be one, and even teaching and language. For example, one of the reasons that there's so much Greek and Latin taught in British, educational history, was that just to keep them, so they didn't know any German or Russian or Yiddish, for that matter. They were kind of linguistically rather incompetent. Same thing, obviously, in the USA. And as I say, Bletchley Park, the spy centre in Britain, had a large number of Jews. I suspect the same thing is true of the BBC. Busy in Caversham Park. You know, Caversham Park has a listening. People spend all their lives listening into stuff. Now, I'll try and give a huge list here of things which evidence of a sort, which points to Hitler not being what he seemed. Here's one here. November the 21st, 1922, was the New York Times article on Hitler's anti-Semitism being not as genuine as it sounded. Quotes, he was merely using anti-Semitic propaganda to catch masses of followers, unquote. And there certainly were a lot of people very, very pissed off with Jews in Germany. And his function might well have been just to distract most people just to him, because he seemed, he was relatively mild. The beer hall putsch is another thing. There are various anomalies here. I mean, for example, somebody with his stated beliefs being allowed free and then given German citizenship despite being Austrian, there's that sort of thing. There's another thing about the brown shirt killings. If you remember, a lot of brown shirts were killed, and I would guess that was, I haven't tried to check because it's difficult to do so, but I would guess that's to remove Germans who are better clued up on Jews than Hitler. In other words, a lot of the people who were really seriously wanted to take action against Jews were bumped off. There's the business about Jewish financiers giving a lot of money to finance Hitler. Two of the leading donors to the Nazi Party, according to before 1939, Bruning admitted that the Nazis had been financed largely. Although, you know, you get no figures with these people, you don't know the exact amount.
I understand that Max Warburg was financing the German war effort, while at the same time his brother, Paul Warburg, was financing the American war effort.
In the First World War, you mean? Yeah, I'm sure.
Second, I believe.
Oh, well, maybe it was both then, but it certainly happened in the First World War. In fact, they met at Versailles, didn't they? On opposite sides of the table, supposedly, both Warburgs. Let's have a look at something. I've looked at numerous books just to try and, including some alternative ones. There's one here, Montgomery wrote his History of Warfare in 1968, and of course he was at it. He was in the Second World War, and he made a few comments here which I think everybody agrees with. He says in the first place that Hitler's fatal mistake was to attack Russia at all. He seemed to think that the Barbarossa thing was a mistake, although, well, I'm just quoting him presumably as an expert. Now, by mid-1941, the German generals were within 15 miles of Moscow, but Hitler did not permit them to make the final thrust, and of course that would have been the centre of the communications and what he called the capital of communism. In other words, they would have got all the Jews and so on, Stalin and what have you. And Hitler took over direct command from Field Marshal von Brauchitz. That was in 1941. In spring 1942, this is of course after the winter, the Russians entered, I think it was Ukraine, and they were welcomed as liberators, but according to Montgomery, Hitler decided the best method was cruelty and destruction, and he antagonized all the once friendly Ukrainians. Big mistake. That was one of the defining problems in the fall of the German there. And there was murderous partisan warfare was the natural consequence. This is what somebody said, probably Montgomery. But, of course, that's another way of interpreting that, is that Jews naturally wanted partisan warfare, or, you know, wearing false uniforms, that kind of thing. At any rate, whatever, that's the business in Ukraine was a disaster. And in January 1943, there was an unconditional surrender demand by Roosevelt and Churchill, And that, according to Montgomery, was a disaster because it rendered inevitable a fight to the finish. You see, Montgomery thought in terms of the conventional war, he thought that there's A fighting B, and there'd be a winner. But of course, from the Jewish point of view, they didn't want a sudden cessation. They wanted a lot of Germans and a lot of Jews to get killed, to get shot.
Well, also, there's the business at Dunkirk. You know, from what you're saying, that starts to make more sense why Hitler let hundreds of thousands of British troops go free in Dunkirk when he had them cornered.
I think Dunkirk, that's an interesting thing. I think one of the reasons, actually, was to keep... They wanted Vichy France. It made... If you look at the map of the world, you've got Germany that's about the size of Texas, I think, or smaller than that with bits cut off it, versus the entire rest of the world. So if you've got France as well, it makes it look more of a fight, you know, more of a fair fight. I think there was an aspect of that to it. Plus also Vichy France had it had an empire in, for example, in Vietnam and North Africa. And I think the Americans had their eyes on the assets there as well. But anyway, as you say, there's something, there's oddities there, oddities throughout the whole thing, and there is a theory that it was not possible to attack Dunkirk. It was too difficult. It was too marshy. I don't know for a fact, but it sounds suspicious to me. I mean, they had all their equipment was designed to go through difficult terrain, so I don't buy that personally. There's another interesting thing, of course, is that that Eisenhower was promoted from nothing. I think he came out like 148 out of 150 in his class or something. And of course, this is what Jews do. You have to watch for promotions of people just because they're Jews, not because they're competent. And if you look at such things, if your hypothesis to work on is that Jews want to kill off whites, you can see they build up sort of both sides. And they force them to fight. And of course, they've got all the information and intelligence. Basically, the whole thing can be regarded as a kind of game where Jews are shepherding people around and controlling the propaganda and having enough people in control to play a bit like a video game, same sort of thing. There's another example here which sounds convincing as well, is that Hitler refused to take Gibraltar from the British. You know, the Spanish had just won the Spanish Civil War, assuming that's the way it appeared to be. So Gibraltar, of course, is on the tip of Spain, and the Mediterranean could have become German, a German lake. All they had to do was drive through Spain and get it. So that's a convincing thing too. And here's another piece of suggestive evidence. That the people who tried to kill Hitler were Nazis, weren't actually party members or in the military. It says here that the Americans, British and the USSR didn't try to kill Hitler. And somebody says here that it's known that the British refused to allow assassination plans to proceed. So that's an interesting argument. Now here's some other technical things here, which is Hitler refused to authorize the production of jet fighters. There was the Heinkel HE-178 had its first flight in 1939, but the Jews, Milch, Goering, Hitler showed no interest. The fighter version was demonstrated in April 1941, and again they refused to put it in production. And the same with Messerschmitt jets. sorry, I'm not being very articulate. There's another very interesting, and a very major thing, actually, one of the biggest events in the Second World War, which is in Kursk. There was a delay. Hitler supposedly, I'm quoting here from just written, printed stuff, that Hitler delayed the attack for more than 4 months, giving the Soviets time to build defensive lines. Of course, the Russians were not interested. The Russians were slaves of Jews. All they wanted to do really was to get away or have peace, but so long as there's a war propaganda and all the time, they didn't have much choice. They were bullied around. The Soviets had something like 1.3 million soldiers there, and they had a list of things, you know, 3,600 tanks, 20,000 artillery pieces. How much of this is genuine, whether the equipment was competent or whether they had the munitions and stuff. I just don't know. But Kursk was planned. Hitler supposedly actually told the Soviets, if that wasn't enough, there were several people, including Zorge. There was a journalist, German journalist called Zorge, who had chin wags with Stalin. I quote here, an attack anywhere other than Kursk would be fatal for the Soviets, but the Soviets seem to know that the attack will come only at Kursk. To incur the maximum possible number of German casualties, Hitler orders the Germans to attack at Kursk as promised, and also that the most heavily defended line ever constructed. But the odd thing that happened here is that a Panzer Corps, Liebstandarte, whatever that means, I don't know, took it on, and in 2 weeks later they went right through all the defensive lines and were starting on the reserve Soviet battalions. And then Hitler stepped in and stripped this group of their tanks and sent them to northern Italy, where they wait a few months. At that time it was the pretext for invading Sicily. So anyway, the Kursk thing, where the vast numbers of people were killed, and that's not counting, of course, the starvation and so on. That's on its own is highly suggestive that the whole thing was arranged. That's quite well known, this business of the 25th of August, an agreement between Germany and Zionist Jews, and under the Anglo-Palestine Bank in British Mandate Palestine. I'm a bit suspect, actually, about the whole thing about Israel, because obviously Jews like living in urban areas. They like being parasites in other countries. They're not usually going to want to be stuck in a separate little place. So I think that it was either a bolt hole or whatever. There are various possibilities. I don't think it's as important as people can make out.
I think it's a sanctuary for them to run to, because they don't really have extradition treaties with the other nations. You know, that would be very anti-Jewish, because Jews regard themselves as supreme, you know, God's chosen people.
And, yeah, that is true.
We had the recent case where the all these so-called threats against Jewish institutions in America that forced Amazon to ban all these books suddenly was found out to have come from a Jew out of Israel. He was behind them all. And rather than extradite him to the US, where the crimes had essentially been committed, they said, no, we'll deal with him ourselves in Israel. So
there's no question about the boat hole argument, yeah. I don't know how important it is, because if they control countries anyway, in the US, they've had no problems, not many problems, in suppressing truth about the First World War and the Second World War. But, of course, I take your point. It's an issue. I don't know that it's as important as people make out, really. But at any rate, that's the Havre Agreement, that was. There's another suggestive point, the so-called Nero Degree, as the so-called Allies, the All Lies, penetrated deep within Germany. Hitler gave a decree to ordering the destruction of the infrastructure, and I mean that was not going to do the Germans much good, is it, presumably? Now, there's, of course, you have to bear in mind all the money as well. In 20th of February 1942, $1,000 million. I mean, in those days, you know, a billion was a lot. That was in February 1942. That was a loan made from the USA, or I suppose in practice that meant that the Federal Reserve, printed a lot of money, and it was the Russians, they couldn't spend it internally very well. There was nothing to spend it on, so they would buy, in effect, American taxpayers into the future were asked to pay to give tanks and material and stuff and torture equipment and this kind of stuff to the Jews in Russia. There's another book I looked at here, just as a sort of reminder. I mean, everybody knows this, really. There's a book by Joachim Hoffmann called Stalin's War of Extermination. There was an English translation in 2001, and of course, even the title of it suggests that it was Germany versus Russia. There's no mention of Jews anywhere in his book. He had to call them Bolsheviks, that sort of thing. And this was Churchill looking back. And even by 1924, the Jews had murdered there's a list, 28 bishops, 1,219 priests, 6,000 professors and teachers, 9,000 doctors, 12,950 landowners, 54,000 officers, 70,000 policemen, 193,290 workers, 260,000 soldiers, 355,250 intellectuals and tradesmen, and 815,000 farmers. And you see, there's a lot of people, they comment on what a surprising contempt for human life, but of course they weren't Jewish lives. There was a contempt for non-Jewish lives. And page 256 of his book, there's much the same stuff about Stalin. He just lied. He said, oh yeah, we're going to stick to all these agreements and so on. Of course, it's all lies. There's some interesting comments in Hoffman about commissars being used for what they call supervision. In other words, you'd have Jews who would shoot at troops trying to chuck their arms away or desert or whatever. And page 190, there's Ehrenberg, the propagandist, you know, with his repulsive propaganda is probably considered necessary because they had to keep the war sort of psychosis going. Anyway, Ehrenberg, he invented the 6 million figure, according to Hoffman. Instead, it's worth noting some books that people might like to look at. For example, there are books on great military disasters or, you know, days that changed the world, that kind of sensational stuff. They're not usually much good because they're kind of vetted. You know, there's no, you tend not to get stuff relevant to Jews in Russia. You do get some books on great Soviet disasters, which can be quite interesting, although they tend to include things like cosmonauts and various fake things, and they're generally written by Jewish American journalists, so you can't expect much there. I was quite interested to look at Clive Ponting's book on, in 1994, on Churchill, which is supposed to be the first revisionist book, but it's not really very good. There's Victims of Yalta. This is Nikolai Tolstoy on repatriation of what he calls Soviet citizens, that is to say, people who weren't Jews being sent back to be killed in the USSR. And it says here, British complicity and hypocrisy with Stalinist terror. And you have to laugh, the whole war was Britain's complicit with Stalinist terror. And there are sometimes, probably some of the best books really are these ones which were sort of partisan. There's one on Australia I've got here, which takes a dim view of Britain and Japan and so on. And there are lots of books, there must be books in for example, Czech. The Czech Jews are widely hated, and in Poland and in all these little countries, Greece is another one. Another quite interesting book I looked at was a big book. It's called 2,194 Days of War. It's printed in Milan, a great big format thing. And it's interesting to be reminded in a conspectus of all these things. There were about 100 cases of wars and breaking off relations and declarations of war. For example, I'll pick out a few here. There's Ecuador declared war on Germany and Japan. Ethiopia declared war on the Axis. Iran declared war on Germany. Canada and New Zealand declared war on Finland, Hungary and Romania. There's obviously something strange going on. It's obviously something arranged behind the scenes. Now, the very first book that I'm aware of, or booklet, is a pamphlet called The International Jew by Eric Butler, who's Australian, in 1946 or 47. And I can't find it anywhere. That's supposed to be the first one known that I've found, anyway, giving the idea that Hitler was an agent. I suspect, actually, that William Joyce, it might have been Lord Haw-Haw, might have been murdered for working out the same thing. I think he might have been disappointed. He wrote a book called The Twilight of England, which actually was quite good. When he was only in his mid-30s or so. And now it's worth noting here, this bit about Trump as Hitler, what's going on there. And I think that's an in-joke between Jews, because if Hitler was just an agent, what they're saying is one of the Jewish policies is to announce things so that the Goyim can say they were warned, so it's their own fault for not picking up the points. You had that with the Titanic sinking, for example.
And also, I mean, what you're saying Ray, I just want to throw this in. It kind of brings back the memory of the Albert Pike letter to Mazzini, talking about the three world wars, and this was planned in the late 18. This was written in the late 1800s.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, who would have thought that somebody called Pike would have been a sort of major figure? But that's absolutely right. Anyway, you see what I mean about Trump? His
yes,
it could be an injury if because you know we can now. It's obvious now that Trump is not going to do anything useful. He's not going to investigate, presumably anyway, not going to investigate 9/11. He's not going to do a range for Fed to be audited. He's not going to look at banks which were speculating and want their people who deposited money to be fleeced for it. He's not going to. If you remember, there was an incident just a couple of weeks ago. I think it was in Los Angeles airport. The whole thing was closed down while some Jewish plane flew out uninspected. It has I don't know what that was, but will Trump investigate it? Do you want to lay any odds? I'd say almost certainly not. So I think Trump, disappointing though it sounds, the best he can offer to whites in America is, you know, jobs for Jew-owned companies. That's probably bad. but anyway, this is what's behind the Trump as Hitler thing. It's a little joke. Anyway, we've got. Let me just look into here about spying, just to make this a bit more clear. They had hidden microphones even in the First World War. There's a book by Ferdinand Tuohy. I'm not quite sure how you pronounce it. Ferdinand Tuohy, The Secret Corps, published in 1920. They bugged prisoners of war with secret microphones, and there were, of course, the Germans had wiretaps. And David Irving, he wrote a book called 1967, I think, Breach of Security, and that was summarizing wiretaps that Goering made. This was called the Forschungsamt Agency, which is, it had a code-breaking section too. And in 1939, it was revealed in 1968, of course, a long time after the war, that Britain got from Polish military intelligence, they got the machines for decoding German ciphers. That must have been the Enigma machine, I presume, because that was after Germany had invaded Poland, or if you like, been forced to invade Poland, or maybe they did it to help out the large number of Jews who were in concentration camps, or camps now in Poland, because the Germans had a policy of dumping unwanted Jews into Poland, which is not very well known. There's a mention of it in one of David Irving books. Anyway, there's an awful lot of this stuff going on. There's not much information on this, the Forschungsamt. The operatives were rounded up and coerced into allied post-war agencies. The surviving archives taken in by the National Security Agent, so presumably that would be kept secret. They've got brown paper and mauve ink. Apparently, that was a secure thing of this. I think David Irving, he published a book in 1989, Das Reich hört mit, the Reich hears with, but I don't know. I don't think he's translated it yet into English, although he might do. Instead, I've read that the GCHQ was actually privately funded, believe it or not. I think it's another Jewish thing, essentially, if that's the case. In fact, I was told the same about Interpol. You get these things which present themselves as being national or international, but often they appear to be, you know, Jewish. I've heard different versions of this Bletchley Park thing. I mean, one of them is the German submarine forced to surface and the machine taken to Berlin, away from Berlin. And another one is the every morning they'd set wheels on their computers, you know, and somebody apparently would record it, you know, listen to it and work out what the settings were. But I don't know if that's true. I'd be surprised, actually, if this all the stuff about Turing is true. I mean, in those days, computers were very naff things. I don't suppose there's anything like as much as is made out there. Incidentally, the Japanese codes were broken. And of course, this is how they knew the Pearl Harbor thing was planned, and it's why they kept quiet about it, so that the gullible Americans could all support war against Japan. While, of course, the actual damage done at Pearl Harbor was a few old ships. Anyway, all that kind of stuff is quite interesting. Let me just look at a couple of examples of people who've impassioned people on the whole issue here. And here's one. How come all the key historians, revisionists, in all their collective years of detailed research, haven't come across this idea? You know, there are heaps and heaps of researchers, and none of them have come up with this idea. And I agree, it's unquestionably true that David researched a lot into official archives and private records and diaries, but the maximizing of non-Jewish deaths isn't likely to show up with such searches. You need to investigate Yiddish and Hebrew sources, which may have been word of mouth only or faked, and archives, and you'd have to try to interview Jews in Germany and the Soviet Union, and of course the cooperation of Jews would be extremely secret. I mean, it would be virtually like a habit of mind. It's unlikely that people like the Rothschilds, Warburgs, or the Jews controlling the gulags and Pravda and that sort of thing, and people like Soros, would they be willing to talk to David Irving? Obviously they wouldn't, there's no question about it. What about the officials and businessmen? They wouldn't. I mean, David had problems just getting to ordinary archives, and of course even many government files are still closed. So I think there's a lot of evidence out there waiting to be discovered, and so I'm not convinced by the argument that people have researched deeply. Now, another argument is that Hitler abolished usury. I'll just quote the person here. The Jews' number one control weapon is usury. Why would the Jews allow a leader or agent to show the results of a country without this parasitism, knowing it will be broadcast throughout the world? Look what can happen if you get rid of the parasite and the parasite's main tool. An agent? Nah, can't be true. But my argument is that usury is not, in fact, the number one control weapon. I mean, the main money weapon is control of finance itself, and also, of course, information. Usually it's a small bearing compared with that. The Jewish, the way the money thing works is they buy up stuff at fire sale prices, you manufacture depressions, and compared with that, usually is nothing. The reason that this argument is brought up, I think, is aimed at German Roman Catholics, because that's, with them, that's a major casus belli, as it were. And even that is assuming that the cathedrals and so on ever actually, the church ever did oppose usury. I think if you look at cathedrals and churches, look at the sheer quantity of them that must have been used to keep churches in debt, in fact. So I think that the monopoly of loans being given to Jews is a sort of quid pro quo. I mean, the money, the work they did was not something that was that difficult to do. All you do is have money and lend it out and stuff.
Not my research showed that the Rothschilds got control of the Vatican Bank, I think, in 1827.
Yeah, that's right, absolutely. So all the stuff there about usury and so on, I think is probably wrong. The poor old Catholics were sort of screwed over that. Just in the same way that, of course, in Protestant countries, the Jews owned money there. There's another point that the information on the Talmud is also kept to a minimum by churches, even though they must have known that it was important. It was known certainly since Luther that the Talmudic stuff was kind of inflammatory. But what they said was that, it's such a shocking book, we'll destroy all the copies. So that removed them from circulation. So that's the let me, okay, how was the time now?
Right, you've got about 10 minutes left.
Let me give a sort of possible parallel which illustrates how Hitler could have been oratorically famous and all the rest of it, but still basically an agent. I'll pick here an example which is George Galloway. He's, I would guess, I mean, I've got no evidence of this, no evidence apart from general plausibility, that he's from a family where there was, where there were Jews who landed or changed their name to a Scottish name, and now he appears to be British. But in fact, his, I mean, you know, when he was young, they were all red marks, this kind of stuff. So my, also he's known, I mean, I'm not sure if I discovered this, but it was on an oratorical performance in what's the Oxford, I forget what they call it, it's not part of Oxford University, it's presented as though it is, but it's an Oxford outfit, and he said in that, that he'd, when
the
he was
Oxford
in Africa,
Oxford Union?
Oxford Union, yeah, that's it, and he was saying that he's, all the people, when he was in Africa, he was doing, he was in this anti-apartheid stuff, trying to damage whites. I mean, that's a Jew, everybody knows that's a Jew thing now, by now. And he said, you know, every single person that he, whose car he drove in, who fed him, this kind of thing, they were all Jews. And he also said that, believe it or not, that in the, I think it was the 18th and 19th century, all the greatest men were Jews. Absolutely fantastic. The thing I'm thinking of in particular is this very much advertised appearance at, I think it was a Senate hearing on Iraq. And what makes me suspicious is there are plenty of war crimes and what have you by Americans. How many of them get very well publicized meetings in the Senate or the Congress, you know, advertised around the world? I should say none of them, really. How, you know, how many cases are there of investigations into the Fed or into you know, chemical warfare in Vietnam or anything, really, or brothels in Israel? Of course, you don't get any appearance of that. So his, I think it was just staged, and it was quite good. I mean, it was well done. There he is going on about having been traduced. You have traduced me, and I know that America has poor quality stuff. So, but there he was talking about Iraq, did he? But of course, the Arabs are known to have been financed by Jewish money. A lot of the Arab so-called princes, a lot of these people are just Jew patsies, and you know, they're kept there by violence. And you know, it might be worse up without them. I don't know. I'm not,
well, the Saudi royal family is Jewish, I believe.
I believe that too. Yeah. Did George Galloway, in his impassioned plea, mention that? Well, I don't know. I don't think so. I'm pretty sure he never did. So you can have a very convincing display of oratory and all the, you know, carefully thought out sentences and stuff, utter bullshit, all of it bullshit. And I think, you know, Galloway is that, he looks like a Jew plant to me. He's got this thing about Muslims, and of course Islam is itself a Jewish sort of byproduct. If you look on my website, I've got some evidence for that. I think my personal view is that Jews invented, or rather took over, Christianity. They sort of redefined it by intense repetition, like the Hollow Hoax, same sort of thing, by complete repetition. Eventually their fictitious character got inserted into Christianity, I think, and the same thing happened with Muslims anyway. So Galloway, presumably being a crypto-Jew, is happy with having Muslims flooding into Britain, even if they might rape a few people. But yeah, you're a Jew, you don't. Yeah, if you're part of the master race, you don't worry about.
How about the Lily Allen comment where she said that with regard to a million rapes by Muslims in the UK, it doesn't matter because they'd have been raped anyway, and of course she's a Jew.
It's disgusting, isn't it? You have to. This is why I say my subtitle was. Was how the master race won the Second World War. You know, people like Lily Allen, I mean, they're absolute shit, aren't they? Just shit. And it's the same with a lot of these other Jews. Like the Dimblebys, for example, are both Jews. And actually, that's quite a good point made by Miles Mathis, that the intelligence people, quotes, like twins. For some reason, they like a pair of them. The Dimblebys are two of them. So the Attenboroughs, actually. I mean, Attenborough, the one who's got the reputation as being, you know, the green and so on. When he was young, he was part of. He was in the BBC. He was controlling the news. So when the people like Germans were being starved to death, you know, in the sort of killing fields, he was responsible for keeping it secret. You know, he's an absolute lump of shit. You know, really, there's no, you know, there's no polite way of kind of saying it. Really, you have to get to these disgusting. But there's another interesting example on the subject of Welsh and Irish and so on. Oh, by the way, I suspect also that quotes Professor unquote Evans in the Irving case was Jewish, or has Jewish ancestry, judging by the he says things like, when Irving enters a room, the room is defiled. That's that kind of stuff. I mean, he's not a historian. The other two I was going to mention were Sutherland, you know, this very fat chap, and Shatter, the quotes Irish Jew, both of them very, very concerned to get immigration into white countries.
Sutherland was the guy that was at Bilderberg a lot, wasn't he?
I think he was with Goldman Sachs as well. Absolutely curiously repulsive, aren't they, these people? They're kind of fat, obscene, like a bit like Jabba the Hutt, if you if you watch trash TV. But I mean, Shatter was it shows how you infiltrate. They sound exactly like, the accents and stuff is exactly like their host populations. And yes, well, there we are. Now, the question is, where's the possible? Well, the first thing to understand, of course, is that there's this completely written out aspect of the Second World War, and also wars going back a number of centuries, which is Jews. Jews are essentially like another country, but it's arranged differently. It's not, instead of being a geographical thing, it's arranged as a sort of string of beads or something across there, which keep in touch as best they can, and either with land, with land bridges, or with the sea ones. And of course, they've got their own language. It's not very different, actually, from, for example, the British Empire, as it's popularly conceived, or for that matter, the Catholic Church. I mean, there is a lot to be said for having organisations which act internationally, because you get, obviously, there are going to be clashes and occasions where it's necessary to discuss things. So there's a lot to be said for having it. I mean, it's just, unfortunately, the Jews have their particular obsessions, and the result is a disaster. But anyway, so obviously the point is, you've got to have this awareness of Jewish influence, and the next thing is you have to have is appreciation that that's only an approximation. They also interact with their host countries, and you get things like the Freemasons, which incidentally both Hitler and Mussolini got rid of, or were supposed to have got rid of. And how to interpret that was an interesting question. It may be that some of the people who are Freemasons were uneasy about being roped and corralled in with Jews, so maybe there was internal friction in Freemasonry. But you're not going to find that. They're very secretive people. They're liars. They're in it for the money. They're corrupt. So, but at any rate, that's worth bearing that in mind as well. It's the interactions between Jews and the local populace, very, very important. And this is relevant, of course, to try and work out some counteraction. I mean, for instance, anything that presumably weakens Jewish networking would be a good thing. If anything that reduces communication between them or obstructs it, or conversely, anything that improves communication between whites and others would be presumably a good thing. And of course, this, to some extent, this is happening with internet in a way which is unprecedented. I mean, you've even got machine translation that's possible to, and videos and stuff, it's possible. And of course, you know, you have to bypass, you have to kind of try and ignore the inevitable lies and obstructions that Jews are going to make, which they don't seem to have. This seems to be the only thing they can do, is just talk rubbish. I just did a magazine review in my large number of reviews on, it's actually based on just one copy of BBC History magazine, and every page, all of it, every solid thing is Jew-based, you know, Jewish things here, Jesus out, and but written out, you have to learn to read between the lines. Absolute rubbish. It's edited by, well, I presume, a Jew, a bloke called Attar, who looks to me like a Jew from Spain, Portugal, and they've got no it's genetic. I think it's instinctive. They're designed to be parasitic, to meld with their group, to get their teeth into it, and they're quite happy spending the whole of their lives doing it. The Dimblebee is an example. You look at there's a pair of them, and that question time thing has been going for years. And you look at any kind of serious issue, like in Vietnam, there's 20 years of war, vast atrocities, you know, and yet, you know, there he is, Richard. Is it Richard? I can't.
David Dimblebee, yeah.
David, sorry, yeah. And absolutely no problem with telling lies, you know, sitting there.
Also, of course, you've got the nephews. Yeah, you've got the nepotism, and that's I've seen people like, I think, John Sargent, his son's now in the BBC. There's a hell of a lot of nepotism where, you know, and of course the Dimblebees, their father, he was reporting on the Aberfan disaster, you know, so he'd been in the BBC. So it looks like some big, we always call it the brainwashing, British Brainwashing Corporation or yeah. British Bolshevik Corporation. But we're out of time, Ray, but before you go, could you give the listeners your website, please?
It's big-lies.org, but there's also nukelies.org, which is specifically on nuclear weapons, which in my view are another Jewish fake, actually. That's about it, really. I've also got YouTubes as re-revisionist. I try to make YouTubes including information so that people can relocate things that they like. Anyway, I hope that's okay. I'm conscious of being not the world's greatest expert on this, but it's such a big issue, it's so complicated, that it's better to have an overview than just sort of sit around and get look puzzled.
It gives people a hell of a lot to think about, and I can never write up one of your shows and include everything in, because you go in so many different areas that you cover, and that's why people like you, because you're very unique and interesting.